Chapter 21. Ecuador. Betrayed by a president. In Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I describe my relationship with Jaime Roldós Aguilera, the university professor and attorney who in 1979 became Ecuador's first democratically elected president after a long line of corporatocracy-supported dictators. As soon as he took office, Roldós set about honoring his campaign promises to rein in the oil companies and apply his country's natural resources to benefit its poor people. At that time, I feared that if he did not comply with the wishes of the EHMs, he would be targeted by the jackals. My fears materialized. On May 24, 1981, Jaime Roldós died in an airplane crash. Latin newspapers plastered their front pages with stories under headlines like CIA assassination. Now, a decade later, it appeared that all the circumstances in the country were different, but the politics had not changed. Following the trip with Ehud to the Shuar and the formation of Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance, I became increasingly aware of the turmoil that in the 1990s brewed beneath the surface. The jackals had taken Roldós out, but the United States did nothing to address the real problem. The gap between rich and poor, environmental destruction, and neglect of education, health, and other social services were exacerbated when Ecuador rose to become the region's number two petroleum exporter to the United States, after Venezuela. The Indian populations were more severely impacted. The government and oil companies tried to force them off their lands. If they refused to leave, all too often, they had to watch as their trees were replaced with oil derricks and the rivers flooded with pollution. The pressure took many forms. One of them was clearly elucidated on an afternoon when I was visiting the Amazon. Tunduam, a young Shuar man, informed me that he was considering leaving his community. "I'm good at languages," he explained. "The experts at the oil company said so. They'll send me to school to learn English and pay me a fortune to work for them." Then he frowned. "But I'm concerned. Sensak did the same thing. Now his name is Joel, not Sensak. They told him to write newspaper articles against you, Dream Change, Pachamama, and the others who try to help us fight the oil companies. They told him to claim he was an elected representative of the Shuar people and to sign papers giving our land to the company. When he tried to refuse, they said they'd put him in prison."
"What did he do?"
"What could he do? He's writing those articles and signing those papers." I asked Tunduam whether he wanted that to happen to him. He shrugged. "I'd like to learn English and earn a lot of money." He swept his arms out toward the forests. "All this is disappearing. The missionaries tell us we must become more modern. We can't live as hunters any longer." Such stories strengthened my resolve to help the Shuar and their neighbors, the Waurani, Achuar, Kichwa, Shiwiar, and Saparo. The dilemma of these people also fired my interest in the 2002 Ecuadorian presidential campaign. For the first time since Roldós, a candidate appeared to take indigenous issues to heart while at the same time seriously opposing big oil. I was in Shell, a jungle town named after the oil company, waiting for a plane to fly me and a group of Dream Change people into Shuar territory on a day when Lucio Gutierrez was scheduled to visit. By this time, the presidential candidate had forged a unique alliance that included Ecuador's armed forces and the most powerful indigenous organizations. The former supported him because he was one of them, a retired army colonel. The latter, because he had refused to order his soldiers to attack indigenous demonstrators when they swarmed the presidential palace in 2000, forcing President Jamil Mahuad to abandon his office. The colonel instead set up army food kitchens to feed the protesters and then allowed them to take over the Congress building. By disobeying his president, Gutierrez had abetted the overthrow of a man hated by the poor because of his overt support of IMF and World Bank policies, including the highly unpopular dollarization of Ecuador's currency, an act with severe negative consequences for every Ecuadorian, except those wealthy enough to have already invested in overseas bank accounts, Wall Street stocks, and foreign real estate. The conversion of Ecuador's sucre to the dollar was a political issue of vast proportions. It was not only a blow to national pride. It also meant that Ecuadorians who held dollar accounts made windfall profits practically overnight, while the rest of the population saw any savings they might have accumulated plummet. When Mahuá took office in 1998, an Ecuadorian with 6,500 sucres could purchase $1. In 2000, the official rate was pegged at 25,000 sucres to a dollar, which meant that the man who owned a dollar's worth of sucres 2 years earlier now had only 26 cents, while the man wealthy enough to have dollar accounts in an overseas bank had increased his riches, relative to the local population, by nearly 400%. This was a permanent change as the sucre was demonetized and replaced by the dollar. Shell seemed a fitting place for the presidential candidate to meet people from the jungle. The town had been hacked out of the forest decades earlier to create a staging ground for oil operations. The indigenous communities had resisted, sometimes violently. Quito, with the Pentagon's support, sent thousands of troops and established a huge military base that began in the center of Shell and stretched back into the forests. Its paved runways were a rarity in this part of the world. Its buildings housed some of the most sophisticated eavesdropping equipment on the planet. It was said that U.S. and Ecuadorian communications specialists sitting in an office near Shell's main street could listen to conversations held in every council lodge in the upper Amazon. Rumors abounded about missionary groups accepting millions of dollars from oil-funded foundations in exchange for planting hidden microphones in the food baskets and medical kits they so generously distributed. Every time a tribal council decided to send warriors to disrupt an oil camp, army units, helicoptered out of Shell, seemed to arrive there first. On this day, when Gutierrez was scheduled to visit, people crowded the muddy streets, hoping to shake the candidate's hand. Shuar shamans in traditional toucan-feathered crowns mingled with U.S. Green Berets, oil drillers, and Ecuadorian commandos. The atmosphere was festive, old animosities set aside. The cavalry and Indians had apparently made a pact to ride side by side to the rescue of a nation demoralized by years of corruption, inflation, and exploitation. My visit to Shell came only a few months after September 11, 2001. That tragic event, combined with the failure of the Bush administration to discredit and overthrow Chavez, was having a major impact on the Ecuadorian presidential campaign. A cartoon in one of the newspapers illustrated local attitudes. Based on the Old West theme of two men facing off for a gun duel, the first box showed a cowboy-hatted Chavez, holster and gun low on his hip, patrolling a Dodge City street. The second contained a gun-toting George Bush stepping out to confront Chavez. The next depicted Chavez from the back, standing up to a Bush whose face was set in fierce determination. Behind the U.S. president, the ghostly image of two flaming towers. In the last box, Chavez was doubled over with laughter as Bush ran away, his feet kicking up dust, his hat lying in the street. Gutierrez leaned against the wall of a saloon, clapping. Although our plane arrived and we had to leave Shell before Gutierrez made his appearance, that short visit helped me better understand why this election was so important to Ecuador's indigenous people. Like their brethren in Bolivia, Brazil, and Venezuela, they had suffered for centuries from foreign exploitation. They were now determined to end that pattern. Gutierrez was elected president of Ecuador in November 2002. The indigenous people expressed surprise that their man had actually won. They seemed to anticipate more difficult times. The BBC reported, "The victory of former coup leader Lúcio Gutierrez follows closely on that of Brazilian Workers' Party leader Lula and seems reminiscent of the election of Hugo Chávez in Venezuela. Each of these men won democratic elections on programs based on calls for change, for new strands of economic thinking, and an end to corruption. In the first round of voting last month, Mr. Gutierrez surprised everyone by taking the lead, thanks to a massive vote for change. But in a country beset by huge debt problems, a poverty level around 60%, and an unstable and unpredictable political system, the odds seemed to be stacked heavily against him. The new president, during his first month in office, flew to Washington to meet President Bush. He welcomed World Bank officials to Quito and opened negotiations with the oil companies. Simultaneously, relations between the companies and indigenous organizations grew increasingly tense. In December 2002, CGC, an Argentine company, accused an Amazonian community of taking a team of its workers hostage and suggested that the jungle warriors had trained with Al-Qaeda. A startling fact emerged. The oil company had not received government permission from the inhabitants to begin drilling, and yet it claimed the right to trespass on indigenous lands. The warriors maintained that they had simply detained the oil team long enough to assure their safe passage out of the jungle. I traveled to Ecuador again in early 2003. When I arrived in Quito, I discovered that many Ecuadorians were convinced that Gutierrez was cutting secret deals with the oil companies and that he had agreed to adopt World Bank and IMF SAPs. Photos of him holding hands with President Bush were plastered around the city. Indigenous leaders, incensed over the suggestion that they had joined an Islamic terrorist organization, pointed out that if Gutierrez forced them to fight oil company mercenaries, such a rumor might become self-fulfilling. In the old days, one told me, people who felt threatened by the U.S. could turn to Russia for weapons and training. Now there is no one, except those Arabs. The situation continued to deteriorate throughout 2004. Rumors about oil company profiteering and government corruption proliferated. Then the government introduced measures reminiscent of those adopted in Bolivia as a result of World Bank pressures. According to the Associated Press, Gutierrez's, quote, left-leaning constituency soon fell apart after he instituted austerity measures, including cuts in food subsidies and cooking fuel to satisfy international lenders, unquote. When Ecuador's Supreme Court threatened to interfere with his policies, Gutierrez ordered its reorganization, in effect, dissolving it. Ecuadorians stormed the streets, demanding his ouster. "Gutierrez has to go," an indigenous leader, Joaquin Yamberla, told me. "He was democratically elected. He broke his promises to the people. Democracy demands we throw him out of office." People kept asking me to identify the EHM who was corrupting Gutierrez. They had no doubt that Ecuador's president was capitulating to a combination of threats and bribes. Although I could not offer a name, I certainly suspected they were correct. As detailed later in this book, I was subsequently contacted by a jackal who seemed to claim to be that very man. Bolivians, however, were experiencing something very different. Chapter 22. Bolivia, Bechtel, and the Water Wars. Bolivia, like Ecuador and Venezuela, began the 21st century with protests against foreign corporations that plundered its resources. Demonstrations, boycotts, and strikes halted commercial activities along the streets of La Paz and many other cities. Although spearheaded by Aymara and Quechua leaders, the indigenous people did not stand alone. Labor unions and civil organizations supported them. Unlike Ecuador and Venezuela, the immediate cause of unrest was not oil. It was water. During the 1990s, it had become increasingly apparent that water would soon be one of the most valuable resources on the planet. The corporatocracy understood that by controlling water supplies, they could manipulate economies and governments. The turmoil in Bolivia once again was detonated by the World Bank and the IMF. In 1999, the two organizations insisted that the Bolivian government sell the public water system of its third largest city, Cochabamba, to a subsidiary of engineering giant Bechtel, as part of a new round of SAPs. At the World Bank's insistence, Bolivia further agreed to pass the costs associated with providing water onto all consumers, regardless of their ability to pay, an act contrary to indigenous traditions, which hold that all people have an inherent right to water, regardless of their economic status. When I heard that Bolivia had bought into this EHM ploy, I was racked with guilt. The Every Person Pay, EPP policy, was an approach to rate structuring I helped formulate in the mid-1970s. At that time, the idea was applied mainly to electric tariffs and was considered innovative. It contradicted a basic premise of most rate plans advocated for helping impoverished regions since the 1930s, including those adopted by the Rural Electrification Administration, REA, in the United States. That providing services such as electricity, water, and sewer to everyone was essential to general economic growth, even if such services had to be subsidized. Following the REA example, implementing this theory had proven highly effective in numerous countries. Despite the successes, the World Bank decided to experiment with something radically different. As chief economist of one of the firms hired to promote bank policies in the 1970s, I was pressured to develop econometric models that would prove the validity of EPPs. Econometrics makes it easy to justify just about anything, and I had a brilliant staff of economists, mathematicians, and financial experts, so technically it was not a problem. However, there were two issues that tore at me. The first was the obvious moral one. The second was pragmatic. A recognition that the old theory had demonstrated its efficacy time and again. So, I asked myself, why tinker with success? Why risk increased poverty and social unrest? Why advocate EPPs? The answer was evident. The EPP approach would transform government-subsidized bureaucracies into profitable cash cows ripe for privatization, as I would later discover in Bolivia at Kobe. EPPs evolved out of the same mentality as infrastructure loans that benefited foreign construction companies and the local rich, while leaving the poor without anything other than huge debts. On a trip to Argentina, I learned of another reason. These countries are our future security, General Charles Noble told me as we rode together in a chauffeur-driven car through the streets of Buenos Aires in 1977. Chuck was a vice president at Maine, who would later be promoted to president. A West Point graduate with a master's degree in engineering from MIT, he had a distinguished military career, having served as commanding general of the U.S. Army Engineer Command in Vietnam and president of the Mississippi River Commission. Now he was in charge of Maine's water resource studies for Argentina, including those relating to the massive Salto Grande hydroelectric project the country was building in partnership with Uruguay, which would produce nearly 2,000 megawatts, create a vast lake, and flood a town of 22,000 inhabitants. We lost Vietnam because we didn't understand the communist mind. We gotta do a whole lot better here in Latin America. Chuck gave me his best smile, one that was shockingly gentle for a man with his reputation for toughness. Don't ever let the socialists talk you into believing that offering a free lunch buys anything but disrespect. People have to pay for what they get, only way they appreciate it. Besides, it teaches them capitalism, not communism. Look at that. He pointed at a pond in a park we were passing. Water is the future gold and oil combined. We need to own as much of it as possible. That'll give us leverage. Power. More than two decades later, I thought about Chuck Noble when the announcement was made that a single company had been granted the exclusive right to purchase Cochabamba's water system, known as Semapa. A 40-year privatization lease was granted to Aguas del Tunari, a partnership led by a subsidiary of the infamous Bechtel Corporation. Awarding such a license to exploit to a U.S. company had to make the general very happy. But people in Latin America felt differently. The San Francisco-based firm had earned a reputation as an organization that managed to win favors from just about everyone in high places. It had a long history of securing lucrative contracts from the World Bank and the U.S. government. Because it was a private corporation, controlled by a single family, it did not have to open its books to the SEC or other watchdog organizations and adamantly refused to do so. If Bechtel wants the job, don't even bother to bid, I had been told during my EHM days on different occasions by government officials in Indonesia, Egypt, and Colombia. Not long after my trip to Argentina with Chuck Noble, an Ecuadorian contracting officer, a personal friend from my Peace Corps days, allowed me to take him out to dinner at the most expensive restaurant in Quito, and then confided that he would save me thousands of times the price of that meal by advising me not to spend the next several months preparing proposals for a project he knew Bechtel was slated to get. He rubbed his thumb and forefinger together. "Everyone will grow rich," he said. "Me, the mayor, the president, the boys from San Francisco." He grimaced. "Except you. And the other poor suckers who think this is a competitive bidding process." Bechtel's ex-officers and executives include such luminaries as George Shultz, Bechtel president and board member, Secretary of the Treasury under Nixon, and Secretary of State under Reagan. Caspar Weinberger, Bechtel Vice President and General Counsel, and Secretary of Defense under Reagan. Daniel Chow, Executive Vice President and Managing Director of Bechtel Enterprises Holdings Incorporated and member of the Advisory Committee for the Export-Import Bank of the United States. And Riley Bechtel, Bechtel CEO and member of George W. Bush's President's Export Council. Bechtel's management also included my father-in-law, who, before he retired, had been the company's chief architect and then was brought out of retirement to serve as project manager of a huge Bechtel job to build cities in Saudi Arabia. My wife had started her career at Bechtel. I knew the company well, from many angles. Almost immediately after the lease for Simapa was granted to Bechtel, water rates skyrocketed. Some Cochabambans experienced an escalation in their bills of more than 300%. This was catastrophic for the city's inhabitants, who ranked among the continent's most impoverished people. "They're faced with the choice between food and water," a Quechua organizer told me. "The gringos want more profits. Bolivians are dying of thirst. They're told they can't even collect rainwater, that their contract with Semapa requires them to pay Bechtel for any and all water they consume." The citizens of Cochabamba rebelled. Boycotts shut down the city for 4 straight days in January 2000. Mobs threatened to storm Semapa's offices. Bechtel demanded protection. Bolivia President Hugo Banzer acquiesced and mobilized the army. In the violence that followed, dozens of Aymara and Quechua were wounded, and a 17-year-old boy was shot to death. Fearing a full-blown revolution, President Banzer finally imposed martial law. Then, after reportedly meeting with U.S. embassy officials, he announced that he would nullify the Bechtel contract. In April 2000, Bechtel abandoned its operations at Semapa. The people of Cochabamba celebrated their victory. They shared cups of water in the streets. They offered toasts to their new Aymara and Quechua heroes and wrote songs proclaiming this triumph as the beginning of a new era. However, soon it was apparent that they also faced a dilemma. They found that there was no one left with adequate experience to run Semapa. Many of the former managers had retired, relocated, or accepted other jobs. The community elected a new board of directors and established a set of governing principles that identified social justice as Semapa's guiding commitment. The water company's most important objectives would be to supply water to the poor, including those who had not previously been connected to the system, provide adequate compensation to its workers, and operate efficiently and without corruption. Meanwhile, Bolivia's government still had to deal with the corporatocracy. Bechtel was not about to give up its cash cow and set a precedent that might encourage other countries to follow Bolivia's example without a fight. in a classic case that demonstrates the corporatocracy's willingness to manipulate international law in order to achieve its goals, Bechtel enlisted one of its Dutch holding companies. Drawing on a 1992 bilateral investment treaty, BIT, between the Netherlands and Bolivia, since none existed between the United States and Bolivia, the Dutch subsidiary filed a $50 million lawsuit against the Bolivian people. Half for profits it claimed would be lost from its, quote, expropriated investment, unquote, and half for damages. This incredible story of corporate intrigue, greed, and insensitivity was largely ignored by the U.S. media. However, the Latin press covered it extensively. As I followed reports posted on their websites, I kept thinking about the people at Kobe. I recalled that most of the key executives and engineers at Bolivia's most powerful electric utility, the one that supplied power to both the presidential palace and military headquarters, were citizens of other countries: the United States, the United Kingdom, Argentina, Chile, Peru, and Paraguay. This dependency on foreign nationals was, I realized, a calculated strategy, virtually ensuring that the utility would never be nationalized. I also discovered that Leucadia no longer owned Kobe. The electric company had been bought and sold several times since the early 1990s, always by foreign corporations. Leucadia and the others had reputations for merchandising companies at a profit. Cash cows were a good thing, but the quick high return sale was even better, especially since it kept local populations off balance. From all the turmoil, a new leader emerged. Following a pattern that seemed to be turning into a trend, Evo Morales rose out of the indigenous community. An Aymara activist, he decided to take the Cocaleros into mainstream politics. He joined the Movimiento al Socialismo, MAS party. His was a strong voice that opposed privatization and what euphemistically was referred to by corporatocracy supporters as liberal or free market economic reforms, policies that would prevent Bolivia from protecting its farmers and businesses while at the same time forcing it to accept protectionist barriers from the United States. He denounced the Washington-driven free trade area of the Americas as a plan to, quote, legalize the colonization of the Americas, unquote. His popularity grew, and he was elected to Congress. Almost immediately, the corporatocracy labeled him a terrorist. The U.S. State Department described him as, quote, an illegal coca agitator, unquote. Although Morales had been part of the Cocalero movement, a coalition of coca leaf-growing campesinos who resisted U.S. efforts to eradicate coca farms, he pointed out that the plant was used by Andean people as a dietary supplement and medicine long before it was made into cocaine. A remedy for altitude sickness, muscle aches, hunger pangs, and other digestive disorders, coca tea had been drunk by many dignitaries, including Pope John Paul II and Britain's Princess Anne. Nevertheless, Morales was forced out of his congressional seat in 2002 on charges of terrorism. The Quechua and Aymara accused the CIA of masterminding his removal. Within months, his eviction was declared unconstitutional. U.S. Ambassador Manuel Rocha warned, quote, I want to remind the Bolivian electorate that if you elect those who want Bolivia to become a major cocaine exporter again, this will endanger the future of U.S. assistance to Bolivia, unquote. Rather than deterring Bolivians, Rocha inflamed them. Morales declared that the ambassador's words had helped to awaken the conscience of the people. Mas plastered posters onto walls around the country. Above an enormous photo of Morales, huge letters asked, Bolivians, you decide. Who's in charge? Rocha or the voice of the people? In the 2002 presidential elections, Mas finished only a couple points behind the leading party. Morales refused to endorse the new president, a millionaire raised in the United States, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. Instead, Mas opted to play the role of opposition. Like Chavez after his failed coup attempt, Morales' reputation was bolstered by what on the surface appeared to be a defeat. President Sanchez buckled to IMF and World Bank demands. In 2002, he decreed a huge tax increase. As so often happens in such circumstances, those who could least afford to pay taxes ended up hardest hit. Amid ensuing riots, 30 people were killed. Roadblocks and demonstrations brought the country to a standstill. Sanchez's plans to export natural gas at low prices to the United States and other countries, instead of distributing it to needy Bolivians, further inflamed indigenous communities. Bloody fighting resulted in another 20 deaths. Finally, Sanchez was forced to flee the country. He now lives outside Washington, D.C. The United States has refused Bolivia's requests to have him returned for trial. Bolivians had defied the World Bank, and they had defeated Bechtel, one of the most powerful organizations on the planet. Now, one of their original people, one of those who had been so brutally subjugated for generations, had risen phoenix-like from the ashes of his culture's ruins. In a way, it seemed to me that the real message here was not just for Bolivians and Latins. It was also intended for Bechtel and the rest of the corporatocracy. It was a pro-democracy, pro-justice message that served to inspire the younger generations in Bolivia, the United States, and the world. I often found myself thinking about Jessica's comment as we wound through the Zongo River Gorge. "I'm glad they didn't build a big dam and flood this whole valley," she had said. "It's so beautiful." There was nothing beautiful about any aspect of U.S. foreign policy and CIA skullduggery I encountered during a trip to Brazil, Washington's attempt to counter the message sent by the new wave of Latin leaders.